Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and by extension Australia's economy and our society. Today we're focusing on an issue vitally important to every Australian, the health of our hearts. And we're fortunate to be speaking with world-leading cardiologist Professor Stephen Nichols, who leads the Victorian Heart Hospital, a state-of-the-art specialist cardiac hospital located on Monash University's Clayton campus. Professor Nichols' research aims to develop new strategies to reduce the risk of heart disease. He's also the brains behind a revolutionary new cholesterol-lowering drug, which could be available in a couple of years. Hello, my name's Ron Candlars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics, touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. With me in the studio is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight universities. Professor Nichols, you're a cardiologist with many hats, director of the new state-of-the-art Victorian Heart Hospital, director of Monash Cardiovascular Research Centre, president of the Cardiac Society, and a world-renowned researcher. Where does Australia sit when it comes to research into heart health?
We've had incredible successes. We've seen a lot of the early discoveries, particularly in hypertension, really come out of Australia. Australia's played a really important role on the clinical trial scene, and that's really essential to be able to bring either new therapies or new strategies into the clinic. I think we are and can play a really important role in terms of what social disparity, particularly when it comes to Indigenous communities, are, and we know that there's a global network of Indigenous kind of health initiatives where I think Australia has and will continue to play an important role there. And what I'd like to see is that then evolve into how we develop new technologies. So we have the capacity to do all of those other things here. How do we then generate new technologies and then advance that and then build the economy that kind of goes around that?
Does that mean that we aren't at the moment?
I think we do it okay, but I think we could do it a lot better. I think that—
Are you talking about like commercializing—
I think that's one part. Yeah. I think acceleration comes in many forms, and it can go to a commercialization outcome. It can also just be policy or treatment practice, whatever. I think that Australia has incredible capacity to develop technologies. I don't think we necessarily have the culture quite yet where our research community is really, really given the the environment and the where to kind of say, actually, let's take it beyond that. Let's actually go and start those companies and move that forward. And I think some of that becomes overcome in terms of the way that we train our researchers and clinicians moving forward and thinking about what that looks like.
So is that something that the Victorian Heart Hospital, which you're the director of, will do? Because it is quite unique, isn't it? Because it brings together clinicians, but also researchers, et cetera. So is that something that you would hope would come out of that?
Absolutely. And in fact, the original idea for the Heart Hospital was much, much smaller concept than what we ended up with. It was essentially a building on campus at Monash Medical Centre, which was going to be much smaller in size, much smaller in financial investment, but would have simply have been a clinical facility. It was really the enterprise of both Daniel Andrews coming into government, but also Margaret Gardner, who was really just coming into Monash at the time as Vice Chancellor, who saw the opportunity to build a much larger facility, put it on the university campus, really see how we could integrate innovation into that. We've been able to, in a short period of time, not only build a building, rebuild a clinical model, establish an institute which really then integrates research and teaching in there, but have actually gone to government and said, well, the bit that's missing here is commercialization acceleration. And we've seen that realized with additional investment. A new building is going to go across the road from the Heart Hospital, and it's a research accelerator. And that will be complete at the end of 2024. And so by the end of next year, this whole project will be in three phases. Phase one's a hospital, it's about patients. Phase two's an institute, which is about research and teaching. And then phase three is absolutely about how do we take everything forward. And so that gives us an opportunity to have groups that will teach our clinicians and our researchers about how do we go the extra mile. It will have the groups that will then help them do that, and then they'll have kind of a footprint to be able to kind of move forward from there.
Are there any other facilities like that in Australia or the world? And is this really the future as you see it in terms of health delivery, in your case, in relation to the heart hospital? But is this the future?
I think it's absolutely the future. Mm. I think that the impact word is far more appropriate for what we're doing than we use the translation buzzword for many years. We keep challenging everybody to think about impact and where their research is going. This is all about that. I think that's where our entire university sector is going to have to have to move to be fit and strong for the next 50 years, and you know, and it's absolutely core to what we think this investment has been about. We could have built a hospital somewhere else, and it could have done great things for patients wherever it was, but the advantage we have here is how do we really upregulate the impact of what we're trying to do.
So can you give us some idea of some examples of the commercialization of heart health, you know, medicine that you that you're looking to work on?
Well, I think that it'll be devices. We know that heart failure is becoming a much bigger problem worldwide. It's a limited number of people that transplantation is really an option. The advances in artificial heart pumps, artificial valves has been incredible. The very first research group to move into the Victorian Heart Hospital were engineers.
Oh, right, okay.
Which I think was intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea of how do we place those engineers in the same sandpit as the doctors and the nurses
and
who
is that,
need those
that's,
issues.
That's really fundamental to the success of all this, having the hospital, the clinicians, the researchers, everyone in the same space.
Multidisciplinary research going on.
Chat to each other and walk across to see each other.
Absolutely. And we've been purposeful about who we've wanted in the building. Because our institute is across the whole university, we spent the pandemic making all those connections across not just all the other faculties of Monash University, but you know, all the other campuses of Monash University. Mm. Monash University is a big place. Mm. And it's not just what happens at Clayton, it's what happens in the other health services. So it's not just Monash Health, it's Alfred Health and other places in Melbourne, but it's Monash Malaysia. Spent a lot of time. We've launched our activities in Monash Malaysia, for example. But we've worked with the heads of all of those faculties and schools to identify groups where we think it's a strategic gain for everybody by them being placed in the building. We maintain additional space as a bit of a hotel hot space where people can kind of come in, do what they need to do for a short period of time and then go back to where they need to go to. And then how do we embed a culture and training and meetings and get-together sessions? How do we facilitate the bumping into each other moments whereby, you know, an IT person can bump into a preventive cardiology nurse and that result in a better way to be able to remind patients to take their medications or a better way to predict risk. I was asked a question at the cardiac meeting here this morning. Do I think in the future there will be apps that will be able to tell me as a doctor what's exactly the right therapy to use for a specific patient? I said, not only will there be apps that'll be embedded in the medical record, the medical record will come up in front of you and it will pop right there, and that will need clinicians, it will need IT people, it will need data people, and we've got all of those groups at Monash. It's just about how we put them all together.
The one thing, though, it's great to actually get access to someone like you, because over the last couple of years, Vicky and I've interviewed many people about commercialising research, and Australia doesn't have a great track record at doing this. But it seems like this model is, you know, built around this notion of doing exactly that. What do you think are some of the biggest impediments to commercialising internationally heart health research that you're doing?
So we absolutely need an enabling environment in this country. So we need to be funders. And there are funders, but we need to grow that. You know, we know that cardiovascular research has a return on investment somewhere in the order of 9 to 1. And that's when you look at the research that has occurred in Australia. So I think that return on investment could be much greater mm-hmm. when you start to get into some of these kind of novel technologies. We've got the world's leading pharmaceutical sciences faculty at Monash. The idea of how do we take a drug and actually take it through and actually get it into a situation where it's acquired by a multinational is a big deal. So there's no doubt we need funders at the table and we need to grow that space. We need a culture to train our people to think differently. I've always been of the view that our clinicians have incredible research capacity because at the end of the day, they know where the gaps are. Mm-hmm. They know what they can't do or they know what they wish they could do better. And how do we harness that potential from just being frustrated in the hallway to actually getting them in a room where somebody goes, I've got a solution for that. Mm-hmm. And so I think training and getting people to think that. If you go to places like Stanford and you ask people there, what's the secret source of success here? They'll say, well, you know what? Our tech office actually isn't any better than anywhere else. Yeah, sure, there's a whole bunch of venture capital firms around the corner. But what works there is there's just a culture that people had a go. Mm-hmm. And in every hallway, there was somebody that started a company. And in a lot of hallways, there's somebody who had a lot of success with a company. So I think the more and more we build that, then we have an ability to be able to take what has clearly been really good productivity on a research scale in this country and then take it to another level. And that's just thinking about commercialization as an outcome. And we know there's a whole host of other outcomes of acceleration that aren't just simply about starting a company. Mm. That would be simply just as important. So we have MRFF funding to lead the National Stroke and Heart Research Accelerator, ASRA. That is a multi-institutional, multi-state initiative, $10 million of federal government funding with $22 million of additional funding from all of the institutions. So that gives that, you know, at least a head start to move. And we sold that premise to the MRFF that it wasn't just about starting a company, that acceleration could be lots of other things. And, you know, our Indigenous colleagues are a great example of that. They will tell you that we can fundamentally impact health outcomes with some of the things that we're doing and go nowhere near mm-hmm. starting a company. And so how do we embed that culture as well?
And so give me an example of that. I mean, you know, how do you transform health in the regions through that sort of skill?
Health services research, I think, is a space where there needs to be a lot more work done. Policy. How do we just simply get the treatments that already work to the people who actually need them the most,
right,
who don't have the access to them? So, you know, if you think about this, I try to explain to friends overseas, you know, while we are the same size as the continental US, the vast majority of this country has either nobody out there or people who are a long way away from the same healthcare that I can have living in a really big city. And we know people out in the regions do worse. So some of the acceleration outcomes can be just simply how we really leverage processes to really make it more of a level playing field.
And is that something that your institute, the Heart Hospital, is doing or is working on?
Yeah. So when we designed the institute, the idea was that it wouldn't own everything cardiovascular at Monash. It didn't have to become a department of cardiovascular. And we knew there were great people everywhere. It was about how do we come together to do bigger things together. Mm. And one thing that we did in the design of the institute to say, okay, well, we can say that we do trials and we do this and we do that, but this concept of coming up with these grand challenges was really important. And they were purposely broad in scope of clinical relevance, but we wanted people from a multidisciplinary perspective to come together to do bigger things. And the five we went with were women's heart health, big problem, a lot of solutions that we need to look for, personalised medicine, living well, new technologies. But the fifth one was underserved populations. Mm. And it wasn't just Indigenous health, because we know that there are other groups in this country. Again, bad rates of heart disease, bad outcomes, poor access to treatment. It's our new migrants. Mm-hmm. It's people in mental health services. It's frankly people in regional and rural Australia.
Mm. Yeah. I want to touch upon your research and a recent breakthrough, the revolutionary new pill for cholesterol that should be available in Australia in about 2 years, I understand. Can you talk
You've
to
done
that?
Your homework.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my background is in cholesterol. Actually, I did my PhD in the good form of cholesterol,
yep.
which continues
which
to
I have
be
a problem with.
Which that continues to be a question mark yeah. for us from a therapy perspective. But the bad cholesterol story has actually been pretty straightforward, and lowering LDL, bad cholesterol, lowers your rate of heart attack and stroke. Statins have been the major therapy mm-hmm. to do that for many years. They're now generic. They're cheap. They're prescribed to hundreds of millions of people worldwide. But as with all therapies, if you give medications to enough people, they'll get side effects. Mm. And we know that probably somewhere in the order of about 10% of people on a statin will get significant side effects. Probably 30 to 50% of people stop taking the medications over time, because we're asking people to take therapies forever. Mm-hmm. So it's a big deal. Mm. This trial was a therapy called bempedoic acid. It's a new oral therapy that lowers LDL cholesterol. It doesn't get the muscle aches and pains that you get with statins, and the trial that we reported earlier in this year was a 14,000 patient study. Everybody was at a high risk of having a heart attack or stroke, had a high level of LDL cholesterol, but importantly, they all had statin intolerance. So we went out to 1,000 sites around the world in this study and said, give us all your difficult patients. Mm-hmm. And they did. It was really easy, surprise, surprise, to mm-hmm. enroll 14,000 people. And when we did that, not only did we lower cholesterol levels, but we lowered the risk of heart attack and stroke. We've just looked at that data in a slightly different way. And in fact, it turned out the group that did the best were not the people who'd already had a heart attack. They were the people who we thought were at high risk who hadn't quite got to that point yet. So again, tells us that we really need to do a better job of trying to identify mm. people, ideally before they have a heart attack, mm. because a quarter of people who have a heart attack don't make it to hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So prevention is key, and this just gives us another shot on goal.
And looking at the figures, you've said the potential to help between 100,000 and 500,000 people in Australia alone.
Yeah.
So it's huge.
It is. I mean, cholesterol is one of the major risk factors. Heart disease remains the leading killer in this country. There are more than 50,000 Australians who will have a heart attack every year. That will fill most football stadiums.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had incredible successes from a clinical perspective in this country over the last 30 or 40 years off the back of all that great research. But we've got to a point where we still see more Australians die from heart disease than cancer. We spend more money on heart disease than we do on most other areas of health. And we can shift how we spend that money. The reason we spend so much money on it is we're spending a lot of money at the advanced end after mm-hmm. the horse has bolted. Mm-hmm. If we could just simply focus the costs more from a prevention perspective.
And that end is the most expensive end too, isn't it? You know, when you're looking at surgery and all those other things.
Well, absolutely. And yeah. if we can avoid all of that, then how we have approaches earlier on that actually prevent any of that from happening in the first place, it ultimately is a cost saver.
Mm.
Are you looking at like diet and lifestyle as well yeah. in the institute?
Yeah,
and
we are.
I'm thinking here of the Charles Perkins Centre, for example, at Sydney University, which is looking a lot around metabolic fitness and yeah. brain health and all of those sorts of things. Also a very big multidisciplinary research centre, which isn't focused on heart health but yeah. on other things. So I'm just wondering whether you're also looking at the way back in terms of the diet, lifestyle, preventative measures before we even get to the point where you may need to take something in case you do have a heart attack.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm a preventive cardiologist, and actually the community can do a lot more before they get anywhere near me.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. So one of the grand challenges we have is called living well, and diet and exercise are two important elements of that. But just as important are mindfulness and well-being, sleep health, but also survivorship. And that's becoming an increasingly important thing. We know that people will survive other conditions, i.e. cancer, just to find themselves at a markedly elevated risk of having a heart attack or stroke. We are doing a trial at the moment, in fact, of a statin in people who have received immune therapy for melanoma. Immune therapy has revolutionized the treatment of melanoma. It's become a very treatable condition for many, many people who are young. And those individuals are now going to find themselves at a higher rate, a significantly higher risk of having a heart attack or stroke in the not too distant future. So how do we develop therapies from that perspective become important as well?
And are you able to find the researchers you need in the areas that you are, because it's very diverse? Is it a magnet for research from around the world, for researchers to come here from around the world, or are we struggling to find researchers? I'm thinking about the PhD pipeline coming through.
I think that we're fortunate with embarking on our initiative at a very large and diverse university. So, again, the pandemic helped us. We had a captive audience. Everybody was on Zoom. Nobody went anywhere, and it gave us an opportunity to understand to a much greater degree who was who around Monash University. So I think we had a lot of really talented people there. We want to continue to be able to attract people both from a student perspective and then at a senior investigator perspective to kind of grow that. We think that growing a precinct the way we're doing here with the different elements will be an important way to do that. You know, we've opened this building 5 months ago, so it is very, very early days. The Research Accelerator will be another element, and you can imagine how that will, in the first instance, attract specific researchers who probably already thinking that way. It will absolutely attract industry. And if you think about it, our Research Accelerator is going to be smack bang in the middle of the Monash Biotech Precinct. We're seeing the Moderna plant go up out our window at the moment. There's a big block of land right next to where the Research Accelerator is going to go, where I can envision a whole bunch of other parts of perhaps stage four of the Steve Nichols plan to kind of come into play. And then as we can then train people from the entry point coming up, they won't know a landscape that's not that.
Other faculties around the world watching what you're doing?
They are, and we watch what they do. We've looked around the world at this project, and this kind of talks to a question you asked earlier that I didn't answer, to try and understand what we really wanted to do here. So we there are 55 heart centres worldwide in different kinds of kind of forms, so they don't all exist as separate as we are. But we learned a lot about the buildings. We went back and looked a lot about the operations. We've looked a lot about the academic and integration into all of that. We now look more and more from a kind of research acceleration commercialization perspective. And so there's no doubt that we've taken bits from lots of things. We always are always looking because this is just going to be an ongoing kind of process of evolution.
How far away are we from potentially eradicating heart disease? Do you think that that's a possibility down the future with this sort of technology?
Well, the Heart Foundation are kind of just going through their new strategic plan, which I think is now going to 2050. And I think what you're going to see is probably strategic kind of aspirations to halve the rates of heart disease in that kind of time frame. 100 years from now, I think that we have the potential for heart disease to be much more of a niche kind of area of health. And in fact, if you go back 500 years ago, it was a niche area of health. I mean, so this is a lot of what we are dealing with is the results of an interaction between genes and lifestyle. There's no doubt that we are an aging population, and that will create some other challenges. Hearts beat 60 to 100 times a minute. And you can imagine after 80, 90, 95 years, they start to get a little tired.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates some different challenges on a heart than when life expectancy was significantly less than that.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I was researching a bit of this, I noticed you said at one point, while there are some genes that are associated with different cholesterol levels, the profile of genes in a population don't change that quickly. And so you start to think, what do we do differently now compared with what we did 200 years ago? Now we eat a lot and we don't do a lot of exercise. So is the fundamental issue still not so much genetic, but really diet?
I think environment is probably a better word to use. So, because diet is absolutely one element of that. Smoking continues to be a significant challenge around the world, and more some countries worse than others. I think we are waking up to the importance of environment, air, temperature, noise.
You also mentioned mindfulness too. So the mental state, the level of stress that we bring to ourselves obviously is hugely important.
It is. And I think if you go back, you know, a few decades ago, there was this notion that stress caused heart attacks. And then the field moved away from that. When I was a medical student, you know, that was largely disparaged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, heart attacks are caused by diabetes and cholesterol and blood pressure. And yes, they are. But actually, you can have your cake and eat it too in terms of thinking about the causes of heart disease and everything's at play. I when I'm on the wards with my patients and they say, well, I do all the right things and I've had this heart attack. And I say, well, if the causes of heart attacks are A to Z, we know A to F, right? That's why we're still doing research. Those factors are all at play. They absolutely are interacting with your genetic risk. But what we've learned in recent years from looking at genetic risk scores is that if you take a group of people, you know, who are perhaps on the 50th percentile in terms of their genetic risk score, if we change their blood pressure or cholesterol, you can increase or decrease their risk. If you treat those people with a statin, you can decrease their risk. So it tells us that your genes don't seal your fate.
Mm-hmm.
They do set you up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we need to be mindful of that. And what we'll see in the next generation, we'll see many, many more people having their genetic information in one way or another. The question that we ask is, what are we going to do with it? And so just as important as discovery research is, this concept of implementation, whether it's in a hospital, whether it's a person out in the community well before they ever become a patient, becomes really critical. We think that that's a really important role that we can play at Monash. I think that implementation is a local responsibility. Governments need to invest more heavily in it, because if we do that, we find the local solutions that improve the healthcare of the community.
So what do you need from now on in? I mean, it sounds like government's been quite supportive of your facility at Monash, but if you had the ear of key players, what would you be asking for?
I think that what we are wanting to do is to have more investment, but see that to be really strategic investment. How much of that involves government, the university, how much of that is industry, how much of that's philanthropy. I think what return on investment looks like for all of those stakeholders is really critical.
Mm-hmm.
I think having industry on site is really important. I think that academic industry interface is...
What sort of industry would you have on site at a place like that?
Oh, pharmaceuticals, devices, diagnostics. Mm-hmm. Imagine what if we were to develop a new point of care diagnostic that, you know, could... you know, predict who was more likely to benefit from one therapy versus another. We have point of care devices that we can take out into community to do better screening. We've just recently partnered with both West Farmers, who own Priceline, and Novartis to actually do pop-up clinics that we put out in the middle of shopping centres in the community. We talk a lot about how we want people to know their numbers. We want them to know their cholesterol and blood pressure. The government's just extended funding for the heart health checks, which are great. But to have a heart health check, you need to get into your GP. It's really hard to get into a GP.
Yeah.
And every time I go on the TV and sound really smart and say everybody should have these things, I kind of see I see a frustrated GP watching and listening to that, thinking, when do you expect me to see all these people? So I think that ways to give people information and then to be able to triage the people to a GP who most need the GP is important. So, you know, that's a nice example of where we're working with industry to be able to do those. That's just started in a small scale, but we have the capacity to scale that up. But I think that there's, you know, if you think about, they're the traditional types of kind of industry. The non-traditional, the future industries are going to be the data companies.
Yeah.
You know, the digital solution companies. And this is why you've, you know, with these types of initiatives, on one hand, you've got to think about the now. We get to do that running a hospital because in the end of the day, there's a number of patients there in the now and we've got to deal with that. But then that ability to be thinking over the horizon and thinking, okay, well, where are we heading and who do we need to be working with there becomes really important. So, you know, I think that that's going to be key to what the success is. Clearly, our ability to continue to recruit the best and the brightest who really want to do things in an innovative way. And then, as I said, it's about how do we grow the culture in a way that we can train the next generation, that this is just second nature to them, that this is the way, this is what business as usual is going to be.
I guess that was my point about the kind of being a magnet for not just global researchers but industry and students coming through, obviously, because it is kind of flipping the switch a little bit in terms of research but also delivery of healthcare to patients, isn't it?
It is, and what's critical with that is that if we're going to flip it like that, then we also need to think about, well, what metrics are we going to use to judge our success? Yeah. Now it's important that I get NHMRC grants and we publish papers and all of these types of things. But if this is going to be the mindset of the way we operate, then it gives us an opportunity to think, okay, well, what are the other metrics that we would consider to be really important? You know, so, you know, talk a lot about the difference in how much funding we get from category one and how much we get from other categories. Well, you know, there was a time when, you know, it was a lesser thing to get funding for these activities from non-category one sources. Now, actually, it's actually really critically important and strategic. And how much we value patents and companies and those types of things, how do we develop metrics for the non-commercialization acceleration outputs that we value, that we can turn around and say, well, actually, we did these activities and this is what it led to.
Well, it sounds remarkable and quite exciting moving into the future and touching upon something that impacts on so many lives. And it's been wonderful speaking with you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to The Debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.